Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I am your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this October the 8th, still on the West Coast, and already now October 9th, the early morning hour of October 9th, both in the Eastern and Central time zones. And it's so nice to have you here with us this evening. I had a great show last night with Dr. B, and got a lot of email from folks. Everyone really enjoyed the information. It seems like it was appropriate for us to talk about parasites, since we seem to have more and more of them landing on the Earth day by day, hour by hour, and even minute by minute. Not to quote a Doobie Brothers song. Dr. B is actually very, very much an activist in a multiplicity of ways, not just in music and not just in health, but he really takes an interest in the consciousness of our country, our society, and really the whole world. And he's doing a great work, and we're going to have him back on the show again, as I mentioned on last night's show. He'll be back soon. And we're bringing more solution-oriented shows to Evident Footprints, and I should say solution-oriented topics as well. And, of course, it takes a guest that has that ability and that desire to present a solution. There's a lot of fear-mongering going on. Of course, some of the topics I discuss on this show with many of these guests could be construed as fear-mongering, although without fail, we always provide some solutions. What we're trying to do, to the best of our ability, is to awaken the listening audience, those of you who may happen to have stumbled upon this network or this show, maybe by accident, or maybe because some higher source, some higher power directed you to come and listen. And hopefully you're going to hear something that's going to give you some hope and give you some wherewithal to take back control of your life. It's important that we awaken, and that those of us who are awake awaken the others. If just put yourself in the position of one of those of you who consider yourselves to be already awakened and possibly enlightened to some extent, imagine that you were one of the sheeple, as they like to call us, or one of the cattle, one of the consumers, or the useless eaters, and you were looked upon by world leaders as someone who was less than human, someone who didn't deserve to be here on the planet at the same time. What gives someone else the right to make that decision for you? And if there was someone who could awaken you to that reality and save your life or bring you to a higher place in this life, would you want them to tell you, or would you want them to keep that a secret? So those of you who know basically have a duty and a responsibility to share that. The first thing we must do is take personal responsibility before we can collectively take responsibility. And tonight's guest is going to teach us how to do that. He's going to talk about some ideas that he has that I know are very unique, and he's beginning to get some success now in introducing these ideas on a local level. We're looking at a monster that basically, I always say, the fish stinks from the head down. And so our guest tonight is starting at the bottom or at the tail, and he's going to work his way up to the top that way. And that's where we are on this ladder of evolution that these so-called Illuminati masters have created as the reality on this planet. This economic domination, the domination of energy, food, water, all the resources of the world have been controlled by a small clique of people whose greed and their lust for greed cannot be satisfied. So as a result, we have to do something or we're done. Stick a fork in us and we're done. You can shut off the oven, time, game over. Let's put it that way. So that said, it may sound like I'm rambling, but I'm just exchanging some feelings and some thoughts about all this because there's a lot of insanity going on in the world right now. We're going to get us on track as to things that you and then we can do together to change this world, starting right where you live. And it doesn't matter where you are in the country or even if you're in a foreign country, you can apply these same principles. This man has set up something wonderful to assist you. And with that, I'm welcoming back to Evident Footprints. I think this is his third appearance on the show now, Mr. Carl Pearson. Carl, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a great introduction, and I really am looking forward to the changes that can be made and we all see at this point need to be made. Maybe it wasn't as clear a year ago, but in the past 12 months, it's just phenomenal that the things that I've been trying to do really are falling into place as really the last hope, almost.
Yes. Well, I've had the opportunity since you've been on the show the last time, and from time to time I go to your site. I almost actually registered on your MyClad yesterday. But what do I do? Do I register as a talk show host or a journalist?
Well,
or a musician?
The site is there for people to register, but I have a problem, and I need to have a community that will allow me to take the site and spread it among the members of the community, and then I will go out and market the services of that community to the world, but particularly to the 25 to 50 mile radius around that town. It's very low cost to reach, and it can sweep the country that if I'm able to bring in $25,000 to $50,000 a year of income for each participating person who wants to earn money and does what can be done to do that, I think that the people in the adjoining towns are going to say, hey, I want some of that too, and we're going to have a grassroots explosion and expansion, and the idea that we can work for ourselves and not have to work for Walmart, particularly where companies don't want us anymore. They're doing everything they can to get rid of us. They're getting rid of benefits. They're lowering salaries. They're moving jobs overseas. And they really don't want us. They put up with us to some extent, but they don't want us in America as their employees. They're looking to replace us with people who charge a nickel an hour or something in some other country. And then, of course, they sell the goods and services back here in America at outrageously high rates and high profitability, which drives their stock up. But as the stock goes up, it means that we've lost more jobs in America. So don't be fooled by thinking that the stock market, when it goes up, is a great boon to America. To me, a lot of it represents the lost jobs and the profitability of moving jobs overseas. And those profits, when they hit the public companies, which are doing most of this, drives the stock up. And it means that we've lost jobs and our standard of living is going down. That's something that most people don't think about or realize.
Well, you know, you bring up a very good point. Now, I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves here. I would just speculate, I would deduce that if you are taking the jobs out by moving your company to another country and, for the purpose of acquiring cheaper labor, then you are disempowering the very people you've taken those jobs away from to give you their money. They have no money to give. Isn't that a bit insane to destroy your market?
Isn't Walmart insane in the sense that it has its goods coming in from other countries, and the bigger, the more successful that Walmart is in attracting us to buy there, the fewer the jobs that we have left in America, and there will reach a point at which there won't be money. If we can't work, we're not going to have the money to buy goods, no matter how low the price.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I guess, people
have to deal with that. That was really what McCain was saying last night, saying, and you're going to impose, basically he was suggesting that Obama was going to impose tariffs, too, to try to prevent the globalization, to try to fight it. There'll be the imposition of tariffs, is what I read in what McCain was saying last night. We have to do something to encourage jobs. And later on tonight, I'll talk about how one of my four key ideas is going to bring manufacturing back into the areas.
Yes. Okay. Now, I didn't explain in the introduction for the new listening audience that we have that you have a background in law. You're an attorney. Or a lawyer. I prefer the word lawyer, actually, because you're working for your client. But I understand that whether you call yourself a lawyer or an attorney, we're sort of dealing with semantics, legalese, and interpretation of the word.
Correct.
But you're someone who represents the legal interests of another person. You're qualified to represent people in court. You've gone all the way to the Supreme Court. You have fought big business. You have fought for the civil rights of everyday people, and you're doing something along that spirit.
Yep.
Okay. Now, I mentioned the MyClad website for the listening audience. That's MyClad, MyClads.com. Do you want to, in a few sentences, explain to the listening audience what MyClads is all about?
Yes. MyClads is a way that people can change themselves financially by listing the services that they would like to perform for money in just a few key words on the website. So the listings can be hundreds of different listings for any one person. All of the listings are free, and the listings last forever. So a person should put in a lot of time trying to build the keyword advertisements that they're going to place for nothing on the website. For example, a person might want to mow lawns. Those are two words, but that's a powerful ad. For those that want to mow lawns, how else would you describe it if you were looking for someone to mow lawns? You know, you wouldn't say lawnmower operator. I mean, mow lawns, you would use that phrase. But you can use any number of phrases. You don't have to have two words. You could put in many words. But somebody that wants to tutor quantum mechanics should just use tutor quantum mechanics, high school level or whatever. So there are millions of different tasks that people could perform. And rather than trying to stick to maybe just running an elevator, which you might be doing today, you could think of hundreds of things that you can do, you have done in the past, or you would like to do, and just put in those keyword ads in the website, one ad for each thing that you would like to offer, and spend time thinking about what tasks that you could perform that people would want. Look around and try to figure out what people want and then offer that to them if you would like to learn how to do it or if you can do it now. So it's a new way. Instead of trying to get a job where people don't want you and the rate is going lower and lower and you have the withholding of taxation, instead offer your tasks and you get direct payment. You don't have to have withholding. You're not an employee. It's all legal. It's not an underground economy. It's being in business for yourself. So this is what I'm advocating that a town can do, collectively try to get the people in the town that want to earn more income, who are capable of earning more income and wanting to, and get them to list on the website. And if I can get a town to cooperate with me in trying to get the people in the town to join the website, and there's no fee at all. I don't get paid. There's no fee. Registration is free. I will then advertise that the services of the town within the radius of about 25 miles from that town by inexpensive radio, cable, newspaper, and television advertising. But I can't do it for a big city because a town is manageable. I can deal with a small town. I can't deal with Chicago or Detroit or New York. That's too big. It's just it'll have to spread to those areas later. But I want to start off with towns that I can go into, meet with the people, and set up an organization to enroll for free as many people in the town as I can. And just think of the jobs that are going to be created here in helping people determine what tasks they should put on the website. There's a whole new area for work for people to be managing the time. In other words, if you have a town of 3,000 people that are eligible to join the website, and each one on the average has, say, 8 times 6, 50 hours a week of available time that they would like to offer, that's 2,500 hours a year times 3,000. That's a lot of hours of inventory. It's almost like an airplane that has empty seats. All of those hours are empty hours unless we can market them. So I have a way of marketing those empty hours, hundreds of thousands of hours of available time that people would like to earn money by doing something with that time. And I've figured out a system for doing it that can bring in plenty of money. That's only $100 or $200 a day. That isn't that much. So this can be done, and I'd like to do it. This is my best idea as far as I can see. It's really phenomenal. It can just increase the income and the standard of living and help in the area of politics. It'll increase the town that does that will have, I think, a better standard of politics as well. At least that's my hope, that when more people are achieving a high standard of living, that it's going to raise the level of a lot of things in town.
Yes. Have you thought about ways of, let's say, protecting these people who have made themselves resourceful and productive commodities in society? Outside, you referred to this as a task, which is not necessarily income. This is performing a skill for which one is compensated. One would be the service. The person would be, in a sense, the identity of the product or service that they're offering, but they're not necessarily a corporation.
Well, I wouldn't object if a person created a trademark for themselves. You know what a trademark is, like Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Is a trademark. So somebody that wants to give him or herself a trademark and put that in the ad and then let people search for that trademark, that there's nothing objectionable. I don't really want to have any rules to speak of here. I just want people to be able to list the things that they want to do, and I don't want to try to impose standards and say that you can't have more than one ad and that you have to take the ad off in 10 days and that you have to advertise only in one community. I want people to have as many ads as they can put on there to redefine themselves financially. And my website has a 50-mile zip code radius search so that somebody in a zip code 11111 could say that I want to find somebody to mow lawns that lives or has his place of business no more than 4.3 miles away from my zip code, so that the website figures out which ads are eligible and discards all the others, so that you don't have a million ads to look at. It allows you to find the ads that are close if you want somebody that's close by. But in other things like building websites, you don't really have to have somebody in an adjoining town. I've been hiring, and I don't like it, but I do. I've hired many people in India to help me build websites. This website that we're talking about was built in India. I've done some work on it. I mean, I wrote all the words in it, but I don't know how to do some of the writing of interactive websites, and I had to hire people in India to do it. And in connection with that, I wanted to investigate why the India Institutes of Technology is a world-class institution of learning. How did India ever develop something like that, when in the past I've known that India is so bureaucratic that they can't ever get anything done? And I've seen that in the past. And I was wondering, how can India do that? How can they have a world-class institution like that? So I did research, and I found out that the government of India allocated the money to the India Institutes of Technology, and they have built 7 world-class colleges or universities in India in 7 major cities, and they have absolutely no regulation by the government whatsoever. And that's why they're world-class. The minute you have regulation by the government, you see what happens. Regulation can destroy by having too many rules. And I mean, like, education at the high school level, in New York at least, has been crippled by the number of rules that people have to meet in order to teach. And these rules just prevent a teacher from giving his or her best. They instead have to figure out how to comply with the rules, because that is where they're going to succeed, if they comply with rules, rather than if they are good teachers.
Yeah, well, you're describing a phenomenon that's pervasive in our educational system, because of the covert intention to dumb down society, just to make society functional enough to be compliant and subservient.
You know, Don, I never believed thought that before, but I believe it now. I really do. The more I look into these things, the more I realize. In fact, I was told by a New York State official that the reason that they regulate private schools too excessively is that they don't want them in business, because private schools allow students to enter any week. They have much better placement. They have superior courses of instruction that are newer. The teachers are better. And they take the student loan money away from the government schools that are not as good. And that only increases the taxes to the people in New York State. So there's been a deliberate effort of undermining private schools, vocational schools, because they are superior. And that's what we have, I think, probably throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know we're going to be talking about this. Maybe now is a moment when we can discuss this. You have an idea for empowering on the local level, a community to be able to create a community-based education, let's say a college, a four-year college, where for a fraction of what it costs to go to the standard private or public, you know, let's say state-sponsored university, you can get a person through a four-year education for just a fraction of what it costs in the mainstream.
Right.
Now, I can tell you that what I know about the pricing and where the money goes, generally, and you know this, and I think you're going to explain this, how this works, because it's the same system. But there has to be a lot of skimming off of the rates that are charged students. In other words, if a student wants to go to Harvard and it's going to cost $70,000 a year to go to Harvard, they'll pay somehow, even if they have to borrow the money. Well, that money gets put into an annuity or a derivative or a hedge fund, some high-risk but very profitable investment vehicle. And as a result, if that money is absconded with, in other words, if it's stolen or embezzled or it's mismanaged, maybe put into an offshore account, put into a position of undue risk, unanticipated risk, we end up with issues like this bailout that we just had a couple of days ago. In fact, they brought up the student loan program, that this money that we're paying is to make up for the money lost through that program. Well, it's not the student loans themselves that have been the problem. It's what they've done with the money from the student loans. It's what they've done with the hypothecation of the investments and the fact that they illegally put them in offshore accounts, tax-free shelters for a clique of people that know about them and all bought into them. And now they're expecting us to make up for it. I mean, this is more of the same corruption, but more of the same insanity. And you have a very valid reason and system for circumventing that whole thing. And, you know, to tell you the truth, even though I went to several schools that are well-known schools where I studied music, I wouldn't care if they went down on just on the basis of the amount of money that they're charging people for an education, because I'll tell you, it wasn't all what it was cranked up to be.
Let me tell you what I estimate a professor of law at Harvard gets per hour.
Okay.
I know that the top professors teach about 3 hours a week. There's 16 hours in a semester. There's only two semesters, so that's 48 times two. That's 50. That's 96. Let's say it's 100 hours a year that they teach. And they get probably $200,000 or more, forgetting about all the extras or salaries and secretaries and Xeroxing telephone and everything like that, benefits all over the place, sabbaticals. But that means $2,000 an hour they're paid to teach.
Well, that's insane. Now, you're saying 100 hours in a whole year?
Yes,
because
they only teach 3 hours a week.
Well, there's 168 hours in 1 week, and you're spreading that over, what, 9 months?
Well, 3 hours a week times 16 weeks in a semester is 48 hours. Semesters a year is 96 hours of instruction.
Yeah.
So I round it off to 100.
Yeah, you're rounding it off to 100.
Yeah.
And I'm saying there's 168 hours in 1 week.
Yeah.
Okay, so it would only take us a couple of months to accrue 100 hours of work, and we're not making $200,000 a year. So there's definitely a problem with that.
So here's what my plan is, and it's all very doable because I know the costs of a school. I've owned a school and ran a school for 18 years. I created the paralegal field. It was for 15 straight years, it was the fastest growing career field in the country. So I know the costs of running a school, at least a college type that does not have a laboratory course. I don't know the costs of laboratory instruction. But on just lecture courses like law and English and things like that, I know what the costs are. So I can run a school, a college, I can run at $1 per student hour of sitting in a class for 50 minutes. I just need a dollar to cover the cost of that 50 minutes for that one student when there's a number of about 30 students in the class. $2 is preferable, but I could do it for one. So I call it a $2 per hour college that I could create, and it has to be an equivalency college. It can't give a degree. It can't have accreditation. It can't have a library to speak of. It can't have a campus and people living on there. It can't have tenure. It can't have it can't be granted. It can't be given degree granting status. All of those things including accreditation and student loans, all of that requires massive amounts of regulation, qualification, and diversion from the main task of teaching. And it's enough to take to make NYU charge $70 an hour for all of those things I've mentioned, whereas my school, cut down to its bare essentials, can give it an equally good education for only a dollar or two per hour. So the other day I was talking to an old friend of mine from the school industry, and I told him about my idea for the $2 per hour college, and he said that was great. His friend that came in to see me at the same time said, "That's ridiculous. You don't need to charge anything." I said, "What do you mean? I have a dollar or two per hour per student to cover. How do I get it?" And he told me. And I said, "I don't believe it." And I figured out that really the guy is absolutely accurate, that if you have a low-budget school that you only need a dollar or two per hour per student, you can actually raise that money, and this is how it's done. The community has rich people, and they have to be 73 years of age or older. They have to be insurable. They have to be in good health, and they can't have excessive insurance because insurance companies won't allow them to put more insurance on, especially at that age, for fear of suicide. So there's certain parameters that you have to meet. But once you meet that, if you can sell a policy for $1 million to a person with that qualification, and the individual doesn't buy the policy himself or herself, the school would put up the money to pay for the initial premium. But the minute that policy is issued, it's worth $30,000 immediately. It's worth, in the marketplace, for people that are willing to hold those policies, you can get $30,000 immediately. That's enough to pay the tuition for 30 students for 1 year at $1,000 a year. It's a dollar an hour. At the end of 2 years, if you held some of the policies that you acquire, you get $100,000 at the end of 2 years. That 2 years is what people will recollect as the contestability period, that if somebody commits suicide within a two-year period, all bets are off and the insurance company refuses to pay on the policy. But after 2 years, it's no longer contestable. So that's what that two-year contestability period is. If you take a third of the policies that the community provides and hold on to that one-third, then you get $1 million every time one of your benefactors dies. So that's the way you can finance a low-budget college. Setting up a college is easy. You just need an empty office space, chairs, a blackboard, and a different courses, and you hire teachers. Teachers abound in any community. They don't have to be licensed. There is no such thing as a licensed professor or a licensed Only in the government school systems do they license people, but in the regular non-governmental schools at the high school and college level, they're not licensed. They yes. teach because they know what they're teaching, not because someone has licensed them.
Yes.
So the instruction is at very low budget. It's low budget. The people who do the instruction in this local equivalency college will be from the community and the businesses that will be hiring the graduates. Now, if you were the owner of a business and you had two people coming to you for a job and you knew the quality of the local equivalency college and you're aware basically that Harvard is pretty high level too, the student from the local equivalency college has no student loans at all. A person from Harvard owes $100,000 in student loans. Who, as an employer, would you rather hire?
Personally, I would rather hire the person that didn't have those encumbrances hanging over their head.
Because why?
Because they might commit suicide, and I have to go look again.
Because they would take a second and a third job. They would be dissatisfied with the money that they're getting because it doesn't cover their loans. and you would have a high turnover. You would have garnishments, lawsuits. You know, people that are in debt are really, they're like slaves. They're slaves to the government to repay these student loans, which go into the initial problem you talked about just before, and that is that these huge amounts of money that the colleges get, students have to pay back, but right now the economy is such that the expectations in going to a regular college after you graduate are much lower, but at the same time the cost of going to college is much higher. So that the net effect is that we have reached a point where it doesn't pay to go to college for many people if it's a high-cost college. But if you go to a community four-year equivalency college that's totally free, including the books and any remedial courses, what a bargain for the community. Holy God, imagine that the community can give to its residents a free college education, and it doesn't cost the community anything either.
Well, you also build up the infrastructure of your local society in a way that you're not creating just a service-oriented, workforce. In other words, and I'm not knocking a service-oriented business, but most of the people who are in service-oriented work for someone else, let's say like a guy owns a tree trimming company, and he cuts off limbs, he removes fallen trees, he'll dig dead trees up, they cut them up, they clean the yard, they might even plant new trees. He's got a group of people working for him that drift from job to job. Maybe one month they were laying carpet for someone else, and then they went to doing some basic construction work, maybe setting the footers for pouring driveways and sidewalks. Then all of a sudden they get this job with the tree trimming company. And so they're never going to have a steady or a progressively expansive business in terms of the quality of the work and the consistency of the workforce that they have. So when you have people who are specializing in a particular field, you are going to have more creativity and more entrepreneurial input from that base of students that you've created through that education.
That's true. Now, this college would also have a course, elective, in how to start up manufacturing in the area. And one day of that course, or one three-hour segment, could very well be how to employ the parts of shrubs and trees that have been cut by service people and to convert that into products like toothpicks, other wooden things, and sawdust for bars or something like that. So that would be manufacturing, believe it or not.
Well,
so
yeah.
You can find manufacturing. We're not totally devoid of that, but I'm not looking upon that as a big industry, but we need to develop manufacturing, and this college would show people how they can do it in light of the different rules, regulations, theories, the marketplace, and everything else that needs to be considered, that would bring people up to a level where they can honestly start thinking about opening up a manufacturing facility or taking over the ones that have been abandoned.
Yeah, well, you know, I see a need and a definite positive use for even agriculture. When you look at the fact that most people, when they're confronted with the reality that they may be in a place where they have to plant their own garden and they have to grow fruits and vegetables, they have to learn how to do that to survive. If a local community is able to provide in that manner, rather than depending on foreign markets, and we've been forced into that intentionally. There's no reason why our food has to be imported. We have the best soil in the world for doing that, provided that we're not depleting its quality through the use of chemicals and pesticides. So again, that's, you know, I'm just throwing that out there, that's a very practical, immediate need that we have in our society, that we experience immediate benefits.
And that would be the agricultural aspect of the college program.
Yes.
A local A&M school. So we need to be thinking of these things as a way of rescuing the communities from the horrors of the national economy. Somebody today was telling me that we ought to be thinking about opening up a local bank in order to have our savings and our mortgages kept locally, where we can watch them and not subject them to what's happening in this worldwide marketplace for money, that it absorbs money and somehow it disappears. We used to be okay when we had local banks, and I remember at a time when there was a lot of pressure by Citibank manufacturers, Chemical, and others to break down those state banking laws that prevented any bank from New York or elsewhere to open up within a given state. Every single one of the 50 states prohibited other banks from coming into the state. And then they broke that barrier down and allowed the big banks to go out and absorb the banks throughout the country, and now you see the consequence of that we're heading for one bank. We talk about bigness, and it's not good, and that we see that when it's too big, we can't allow them to fail. But look at the way that we're dealing with the failures now. We're creating even bigger monsters.
Well, yeah, and in light, you know, I'd just like to bring up this bailout that comes to mind, that we were told that this has to be done to prop up our market. All that money that they just took from the American people has gone to foreign countries. It's gone, and what didn't go to foreign countries went to California to a resort where AIG executives spent a week treating themselves to almost $500,000 of a retreat. I mean, this is insanity, and these people are now before Congress admitting to this within 1 week after they got this money.
I have a way of dealing with that, and I've always maintained that globalization in its worst was caused by the nation's failure to enforce the existing laws. And I think that you can understand that now a little bit better than maybe a year ago. If I had said that to you a year ago, you might not have understood. But I think now you can see that a lot of areas, if we had a law enforcement official trying to enforce the laws that we see now were not being enforced and have caused us this mess. I'm thinking particularly of the antitrust laws, the securities laws, the banking laws. The laws that are federal to a great extent can be enforced by individuals or by towns that are hurt by people that violate those laws. So I'm looking at creating a position of a town attorney general to do for the town what a state attorney general should be doing for a state. At the state level, it's very easy to deter somebody from doing the job by maybe making an offer that will make you governor, or you can run for the presidency or something. But if you have, we have about 40,000 towns, villages, counties in the U.S. If you had 40,000 town attorneys general, each doing his or her own thing, you would have one hell of a lot of law enforcement officials on the civil side, which we see has been missing, and it's something we desperately need in order to be able to enforce the rights of people in the United States. The rights are not being enforced, only the duties.
Isn't that bribery that you just described to me, Carl?
Bribery?
Yeah.
To enforce the laws?
No. When you said that, you know, let's say the state attorney general should be doing
that's all politics. They bribe each other every day. That's earmarks and everything else is all sorts of skullduggery that goes on. I mean, that's what politics is, unfortunately. And the cure for it is a very simple cure. And I'm trying to create it in New York City. I'm trying to create an initiative of the voters of New York City that would have 100% campaign financing for people who run for office. Forget this campaign financing where the government gives you $10 million. If you can find some rich person to give you $10 million, then the government chips in $10 million. That is not the kind of financing that's helpful to me. I don't want to run around seeking money. I would like to run for office and have the government provide the money that I need to run for office. And I estimate that all of the federal offices in the country, if we have about $5 billion a year, we could eliminate the need to raise money by anyone running for federal office. So imagine what $5 billion a year could have done to save $800 billion and the trillion-dollar problem that's coming up with derivatives.
Yes, well, you know, I resent the fact that they make these agreements that they do match the funds. We pay that. That's not coming out of the government's pocket. That's coming out of our pocket.
Absolutely, and the only way of stopping it is to stop the people who pay our congressmen the money they need to run for office, because the congressmen need to be reelected. And if they don't do the bidding of the people that gave them money in the first place, there won't be any second-place money. It's so obvious what's going on, and yet the people that are in charge are the ones who are not going to change it. And at the local level, we can change it. We can do it at the local level. A lot of what needs to be done at the local level. Let us reform ourselves at the local level, create one hell of a community, and one where the standard of living is better, where the quality of life is better, where everything is better. And we can do that. It's very possible to do that. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I need one community to step forward to do that. And as a test, you might say, just to show that having a free college, having $25,000 to $50,000 of income per person that wants it, that can use it and wants to work for it, having the rights of people enforced at government expense, which we don't have right now anywhere. The government doesn't enforce any of our rights, very few of them. They enforce our duties. They take away our money, put us in jail, but they don't enforce our rights. They say, oh, no, you have to go out and hire a lawyer to enforce your rights. Of course, we can't do it. The cost is too high. We need to use government money to enforce our rights and to provide for campaign financing.
Yeah, you know, I think I have a solution for getting congressmen or senators, our representatives, to vote according to our wishes. And I think every time they have a bill on the table and they're going to vote, they vote according to the wishes of the people. Now, if they can do these votes in 5 minutes, certainly we can take 5 minutes out of our busy day and give it just as much attention and decide, are we going to pay this extra? Are we going to be allowed to be taxed? Or is there some right going to be taken away from us? And we cast our vote. That links up to the seat where our representative is sitting, right there in the Capitol building. And if he fails to match his vote to our vote, our collective vote, and it would just be a plurality, whatever. And we're not talking about Diebold machines, okay? Now, they press the wrong button, whoosh, a trap door opens up, they're gone. Okay? And then we put somebody else in there. It would be very simple that way. No game, no lying, no cheating, no stealing. It's simple.
I've got one other way in addition, and that is that I would give the elected officials 5% of the growth in the economy. If the growth could be a legitimate growth instead of a hyped-up phony growth, I would give them and let them divide up, maybe equally, 5% or 2% of the growth in the economy, so that they're out there working to try to build something for us instead of steal from us.
Yes. Or take that and be required to invest it on behalf of the constituency. What would be wrong with that?
Yeah.
And then on the basis of that investment, then he earns his money from that. You know, he earns his living from that. It may not seem fair, but it would put these politicians into a place where they now had to serve us.
But you know, at a local level, we don't have to worry as much about that. We can actually talk with our local people. We can have town hall meetings. We can educate the town a lot better, a lot more easily than we can educate the country. So that at a local level, reforms that truly are mm-hmm. helpful to the people, I think, can be achieved. And it's going to spread to the adjoining town when they see what's happening. And they see the prosperity of the adjoining town, they're going to say, hey, we want some of that too. And that is a grassroots approach. I think that we can change the country by doing a grassroots type of makeover. We can start somewhere small, and it will spread if we're doing the right thing.
Can we still use my trapdoor idea on the local level?
Absolutely. I even had that in the college. I was going to have a person coming into the equivalency college with a credit card and having to swipe the seat before they sat down. If they sat down without swiping, they get electrocuted. That's $1 a day.
Or just a little shock, right?
Yeah, maybe just a little shock.
Yeah.
But that would simplify it. Instead of having a bursar, just have a credit card similar to the ones that you don't have to add PIN numbers and all that. Just to swipe and you get the dollar.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're experiencing things on a national level, and I think it's important to at least compare what you're talking about to what the Justice Department is going through locally on a state level and then nationally. We've lost the rule of law. Basically, it's just madness. It's like everything's been turned into a military tribunal. People are not, you know, we've lost habeas corpus and posse comitatus. We are no longer operating like, you know, what you see in Perry Mason.
Yeah.
There is no opportunity to present evidence. People are falsely charged with crimes. Usually, it's to cover up the actual crime that's been committed.
Oh yeah,
and you know, you're quite aware of that, I'm sure.
I look, the people in charge write the history, and they can turn the force of government on the people they want to stifle. It's that's the way it works. We need to have different people in the government. We've got to start at the bottom, mm-hmm. and there let people compete for excellence. Let the town attorney general compete in the area against the prosecutor, and let's see if the people like prosecutions or would they like additional income and a better standard of living. Prosecutions are really designed as showcase so that the prosecutors make it appear like they're helping the public by putting away too many people. Do you know that we have 25% of the world's prison population in America, and we only have 5% of the world's population?
Yes, and they've turned it into big business for a select few.
In New York, we have a deal. In New York City, we have a deal with upstate New York that we're allowed in New York to let the people roam around and commit crimes, and then we justice them criminally in New York, and then we send them upstate where they are incarcerated for 20 or 30 years, and it takes a lot of guards and other people. So we give jobs to upstate New York by opening up more and more prisons and prosecuting more and more people. That's the deal that we've reached politically between downstate and upstate New York.
Mm-hmm. And then the benefits to the pharmaceutical companies and the food service companies. And you'd be amazed to see who runs the food service industry for the prison system. The people that have the concessions.
More than likely people that belong to a group that has a good prison record.
What I'm saying is the people that own these companies have, I'll come right out and say it. The company that's most prevalent in the food service industry to prisons is Keefe, K-E-E-F-E, owned by Bob Barker of The Price is Right and Barbara Bush.
No kidding.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Okay, now, this is the sort of corruption. There's got to be some kind of corruption in allowing that to occur.
It's probably without bidding.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it's a no-bid contract. Well,
you see, if we have an attorney general at a lower level, they can look into those things and bring appropriate suit at government expense. If you try to put the cost of litigation on injured people, they're already injured, they have no money, they would settle for money and it wouldn't settle the problem because they would merely take money, settle the case, and go home with a lot less than what they lost. We need to have government money to enforce law, and we need to do it at the local level.
Yes.
Because the highest level is too readily bought off.
Well, you can presume if they have the federal prison concessions, they probably have them on a state level and on a local level. Maybe the only exception would be Mayberry.
You want to know what Giuliani is up to? The front page story the day after the $800 billion story broke, Giuliani was on the front page of the New York Post, I believe, smiling because he said, I'm going to apply for some of that money, and he gets $800 an hour. What he meant was that he was going to apply to be able to bring suit against homeowners that are in default in order to collect money for the federal government so that the federal government gets its $800 billion back off the backs of the people who are losing their homes. This thing is adverse to the homeowner that's losing his home. They're going to pay huge hourly rates to favored political-type lawyers in order to take away the homes, sell them, and make sure the government doesn't lose money or doesn't lose as much. That's not a homeowner's program. That's anti-homeowner. Because at $800 an hour, you're going to have lawyers that are not going to want to settle. They're going to just want to keep working the case and driving the homeowner out of his home.
Well, and of course, you don't think Giuliani's going to keep all that money, do you?
No, he has partners and others. I mean, that kind of money obviously flows back into a system. They might have to get Abramoff out of jail or something like that and figure out how to spread the money. But they've always known how to spread money around.
Or Kenneth Lay.
Yeah.
Even though he had a heart attack and died.
Yeah. Supposedly, right?
Yeah, it's always the same story. Now, you know what, on a local level, just because this is happening all over the country right now, should there not be recourse for things like the Silverado savings and loan scandal, the Keating 5 issue, or a Madison guarantee, IndyMac? Shouldn't there be recourse ultimately?
Well,
and I don't care that they criminally excuse themselves, exonerate themselves through these bills that they're passing, because to me, they're criminals to begin with. So, it's like giving the bank robbers the key to steal in broad daylight.
Well, here's a theory that somebody will be doing something with, I'm sure, at some point. And that is, if you have a company that went bankrupt and you look at how much it has now and how much it owes, and let's say that AIG or some company, let's take a bankrupt company instead, somebody that filed for bankruptcy, if they are $100 million or $1 billion short, the trustee in bankruptcy could go out after the ones that received that money. The excess money, the ones that were paid enormous salaries. And those salaries really should be returned to the company as not earned, as gifts that were unwarranted, especially if you look at the real financial statements and you know that the money was taken when the company was insolvent. If you just reorganize the, or if you recast the financials, you'll see that these companies have been broke for 3 or 4 years, and any monies that were in excess of a reasonable amount should be recovered with interest, so that you could actually collect hundreds of millions or maybe billions of dollars that way. Now, but that's the trustee in bankruptcy. You could have people buying up bankrupt estates and going after the monies that are owed. For example, you might want to put in a bid for a bankrupt company, and then you acquire the claims as well. And people could do that. That would be a business to think about. But the government should be doing this. I mean, that's really what the government is for. And if the government doesn't do it, maybe the town attorney general will do it.
Yes, I'm. You know, these golden parachutes that these guys that were all involved with Freddie Mac, all of them had, I think, some relationship to Goldman Sachs prior to that. And here you have the same situation with the Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, and Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman. All of these guys went to the same school. They worked for the same brokerage firm. And that in and of itself should be a disqualification, I would think, that these guys are in a speculative, so-called speculative market, where we know the laws are being broken left and right, and that they're entrusted with the currency of a country. That should not be allowed. And yet these guys from Freddie Mac all had golden parachutes. Now, I heard McCain yesterday misquote the amount of money that, I think Raines was the guy, that got $240 million golden parachute. They required him to pay back $50 million, which leaves him with $190 million.
Yeah.
Now, McCain says that he only made $90 million. What happened to that $100 million?
Who was financing somebody's campaign.
Yes, exactly. Well, these three guys that work for Freddie Mac all happen to be working for Obama's finance,
yeah,
the campaign finance committee. They're all executives on his campaign.
When you're in high-level politics, it's very hard to get away from the people that have the money. And when you sign up and get people with money, there's certain obligations. McCain is already saying that he would have Revlon or somebody like that, not Revlon, but the other guy, some cosmetic guy, forget his name now, but he was going to have him, that was in New York, I'm sorry. That was in New York. Somebody was going to go on on the committee that redoes New York law. It was sort of like an exchange. The present mayor was saying, we'll put someone else on a committee if they don't do something. I mean, there's a lot of deals that are made, and a lot of them are not good deals, and the public doesn't see what they are. But, you know, one thing I'd like to see is that every New York City and other cities, towns and villages, should require that every check and every payment that's made should be put on a bulletin board, an electronic website, so that the public can see who's getting the money, who authorized it, when it was paid, for what was it paid, so we can see where the money's going.
Well, yeah, that's logical. I mean, Your MyClad site would basically be like a bulletin board, or you know, in the laundromat where they have a little cork board and people can pin their business card up there, or they can post a little announcement or a flyer,
yeah,
or something
that's
like that.
That's what it's intended to be, and you can search through it.
Yeah.
But I want every city to post the money that they,
yeah,
give to people. I'd like to see who gets it, for what purpose, who authorized it, when was it paid, how much, who did it go to. I'd like to see my next-door neighbor and see if he's earning $400,000 and he's sweeping floors for New York City. I'd like to find out why. I'd like to get a job like that.
Yes, that's what I'm referring to. I'm,
yeah,
comparing it to your website in that sense, that it could be a link right there. You know?
Oh, absolutely. So there's a lot of things that we can do at the local level to make things better, and I think if we make things better in one town, that it will spread to other towns. And the town that starts it should get great publicity for venturing forth to make certain changes like this. To me, having a free college in a town, it may be that we'll have to be a certain number of miles radius around the town, because maybe a town of 10,000 may be too small to support a full-time college like that, a four-year college. You may have to have 10 or 20-mile radius or something like that. But all of that can be worked out.
Yeah, now you would do that. That would be handled also by the Attorney General for that town?
No, each of these ideas that I have is totally separate. Has nothing to do with the other. They're just great ideas, I think. And any one of them could be adopted without hurting the others. You don't need to. They're not interrelated. But they all tend to better the community and bring income and opportunity in one way or another. Like, one of my ideas is to have a community employer of record, so that small businesses and households that hire domestics can have their payroll taken care of by a single governmental nonprofit agency, and to split the costs, to make the costs allocated fairly. And that means that you don't have to have 800 separate unemployment insurance policies, 800 separate workman's comp policies, 800 audits, 800 filing cabinets. You have one office, one person, one filing cabinet, one insurance policy, one audit, and it can take care of the whole town.
So you're talking about, let's say, bonding these workers, in other words.
It's a natural idea. There's no reason why it shouldn't be done. There's a lot of things that should be done that are obvious.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. Actually, we went over a little bit, but I don't mind that. Do you have any closing words that you would like to instill upon our listening audience before your return trip on the 21st of this month?
Absolutely. I am looking for a town anywhere in the country that wants to receive these improvements. I'm not doing it for money. I'm doing it to try to prove a point that we can revitalize America starting at the bottom, and that means at the town and the village level. And there's many things that can be done to make the town better, and I want a volunteer town to go into and to help me in doing this.
Well, that's a great idea. I see immediately that it supports what I have been contending, and many others that are not just on this show, but others who are trying to awaken the masses, and that's that we need to begin taking responsibility for our own lives. And this definitely will empower us individually and collectively, starting right where we live. I'm convinced of that just by seeing your site and studying what you've been putting out. This is not something you thought of the day you fell off the turnip truck.
Can I give the website address?
Oh, yes. Yes,
yeah,
go ahead.
The website address, it's a new address. I made it a domain name recently. It's election-issues-us. That means UnitedStates.com. So election-issues-us.com.
Okay. You've got some other sites, too.
I've got more than 100. But this is the most important one. This one really provides the information that people need to bring these reforms to their own community, and I would be very anxious to help out in any way that I can. I don't take money for this. What I'm trying to do is to show that we have the power at the lowest level of government to do something about the conditions that are really making us miserable, and they're going to get worse. We can do something about it.
Yes. Well, Carl, I thank you for the work you're doing, and I look forward to your next visit on the 21st. You and I will be talking tomorrow. So
terrific, yes.
I thank you just so much for being on the show, and I can't wait till your next appearance.
I appreciate it, and we'll talk
okay.
tomorrow. Great.
All right. You
right.
have a good one. And,
thanks,
folks,
thank you.
Have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. Our special guest, Carl Pearson, will be back on October the 21st. And I'd like to thank Donald Newsom for making this show possible and Seth Hendrick for the sound. And listening audience, I'd like to thank you for tuning in. Have a night filled with peace, love, and light. We'll see you tomorrow. In the meantime, have a good night.